From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Talk of Iowa. I'm Janine Beck. It's Wednesday, and as usual, our focus is on politics. It's less than a week until the Republican and Democratic primaries. Polls show former Governor Terry Branstad with a substantial lead over his rivals. Roxanne Conlin has an even bigger lead over her Democratic rivals in a bid to become a U.S. senator. Meanwhile, an interesting primary in Alabama yesterday. Does the outcome there shed any light on Iowa's races? We'll ask our political experts. And what about corporate influence in politics? After the Supreme Court ruling allowing corporations to pay for political advertisements, some Democrats complained about the benefit this would provide to Republicans. But has it panned out? Our political analysts weigh in and take your calls this hour on Talk of Iowa. But first, the news. Good morning. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Janine Beck, and it's Politics Day. My guests are Drake University Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations, Rachel Caulfield. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Arnie, thanks for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Well, I want to start with the fact that we're just less than a week away from the Iowa primary races, but we have Republicans, a full slate of Republicans running, especially a hot race in the gubernatorial race. And then also we have Democratic primaries next Tuesday. And the biggest one probably people are watching is the Democratic primary to run against U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, where you have Roxanne Conlin, Tom Fegan, and Bob Krause. Let's just start with some numbers. Some polls came out just the other day. Terry Branstad, former governor, leads the Republican gubernatorial primary field, besting his closest rival by 15 percentage points. Bob Vanderplaats, he would beat Bob Vanderplaats 46-31%, and Rod Roberts finished a distant third with only 13%. Rachel, let me begin with you. What do you see in that race as we head into Tuesdays? Any thoughts or general observations?
Well, this is going to be 2010, we all know, is going to be a really interesting year because of the anti-incumbent mood of the electorate. I think a lot of this comes down to who turns out to vote. And we've already heard estimates, and we've started to see actual absentee ballots coming in. And they seem to indicate that Republicans are really fired up. And so we're expecting to see pretty big turnouts among Republicans.
Yeah, their absentee ballots were like 3-1
yes.
compared to Democrats.
Yes. And it shouldn't surprise anyone because we really only have two big contested Democratic primaries going on in the state right now, one of which is kind of locked up by Conlin for the Senate. So, you know, this is where our models of who turns out in primary elections kind of get a little mushy. It was expected last summer that Vanderplaats would take this race. He was by far the front runner. So the fact that Branstad has achieved this 15-point lead at this point, whether or not Vanderplaats can make that up in the span of a week, is pretty doubtful.
One of the stories that I read, another political analyst was sort of talking about the fact that Vanderplaats lacked name ID. I
just hard to believe.
By that. Yeah, this is his third time running for governor. He was on the ticket 4 years ago as the lieutenant governor candidate.
Yes.
I guess as someone who's covered him, I'm shocked, but you know, I do cover him for a living.
Right.
But were you at all surprised to hear somebody say name ID is a problem for Bob Vanderplaats?
I am surprised to hear that name ID is a problem for Vanderplaats. However, you have to consider that he's going up against Branstad.
Whose name ID after 16 years of governor is huge.
Yeah. Exactly. So, 16 years is a long time to really bore yourself into someone's head.
Yeah. I mean, 16 years, about that long, Arnie?
Yeah. Well, I keep thinking, as we talk about Branstad, I think his theme song should be Memories.
Yes.
Memories.
Let me bring you in.
This so really sort of speaks to, you know, he had decent leadership. He'd been there for 16 years. He didn't leave in shame. People are longing for a leader that they respect. And I think Terry can actually recycle that theme very easily.
But why no anti-incumbent toward him? Because he's been out for 12 years now?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. It doesn't take very long to lose that incumbent status, I take it?
It's a case of that he has the best of both worlds. He's fresh and old at the same time. Think about that. Again, I think he should hire me for his campaign. But that's what he is. he stepped out of the political eye. He still worked for the state of Iowa. He cares about policy. You know, he didn't screw up in those 12 years. At the same time, people have a memory of him as leader when times were better. And what they want, given the fact that everything is so fragile, is they don't want to screw up with a person who will make a difference in their lives. And more than anything else, governors do.
And this is a Republican primary, though, and this is a governor who did sign into law gambling in Iowa, first the lottery, then parimutuel gambling. And there are many conservative Republicans who are very dissatisfied with gaming in Iowa. So I'm surprised some of these things haven't hurt him as the Republican Party has shifted more to the conservative side. I guess I wouldn't have expected – I would have expected him to do well in the general. I'm surprised at how well he's doing even among conservatives in the primary.
Well, and I think this is where the Iowa Republican Party becomes really interesting, because the Republican Party of Iowa I think has a pretty big split. We see a lot of the very conservative voters, particularly in the western third of the state. But the statewide party, I think, is constantly balancing between – kind of fiscal conservatives from the Bob Rae days who are very active in politics, very involved. They vote. And then you have the social conservatives. And you see this divide constantly within the party. And there's kind of no better image of that divide than Branstad and Vanderplaats and Roberts. So you have this kind
of triangulation. So will we know something about the party after the primary, about where it's going?
I think we'll have a better idea of kind of long-term leadership of the Republican Party in Iowa.
All right. Let's talk about the Democratic race to unseat Charles Grassley, Republican, longtime Republican senator. Democrat Roxanne Conlin now a more commanding lead even than she's had previously over her opponents. 48% of likely Democratic voters said they would support her. Bob Krause had 13%, and Tom Feagan, a former state legislator, only had 8%. Any surprises there, Arnie? I know you don't
from what I
cover Iowa politics.
She's a forceful personality. She's got the cash to burn. People are looking for someone. I mean, I'm going to use Barack Obama as an example here. Barack turned out to be too smooth a guy, okay? He's very smart, but he doesn't bring passion to the table. And I think that that's not true with Roxanne. I think that she will be a dynamic candidate. And plus, she's got money. So you've got to, I mean, people... Packaging matters. I mean, it matters. And I think in this race, especially against Grassley, who's actually begun to moderate some of his positions in anticipation of the November election, which should be assumed to be a shoo-in for him, especially given the tenor of the nation. But I think the tenor of the nation is not about who's there, Republican or Democrat. It's about what do we need to bring about the kind of change that's going to fix the economy, fix the nation, deal with Congress, deal with corporations. And I think that's why she has a really good shot, not only from the Democratic primary perspective, but even from the statewide perspective when she runs in November. It is about personality, and I think she's got to bring a lot of that to the table.
Rachel Caulfield?
Well, I tend to agree. I don't think there's any question that she'll win the Democratic primary. I think that's been locked up for some time. I do think, however, that this is, you know, it kind of sets up the classic dynamic between the parties right now in terms of what we're going to see in November. We see kind of a long-time Republican who has ties to the business community, very strong ties to the business community. So he will be tagged as embracing corporate interests. And she's already started that theme in her ads. In contrast, she has very strong ties to trial attorneys. So she'll be tagged as the trial lawyer's candidate on the Democratic side. So I think it kind of pits these two very typical stereotypes of who's in the Democratic Party and who's in the Republican Party.
Rachel,
Grassley has
want?
Never lost an election. He's never gotten less than 65% of the vote. It's an uphill climb for Roxanne Conlin in November.
It's an uphill climb, but think about it right now. Sleeping with corporate America is not exactly the partner you want. I mean,
neither is being in bed with the trial lawyers.
But that's not true. I think for the first time ever, you can actually reframe the descriptor for a trial lawyer. And I think this is, trial lawyers are stupid if they don't do it. Because it's the trial lawyer that takes on the corporation that screws you. It's the trial lawyer that will be the one to make sure that, that in what happens with BP will not only devastate all the Gulf Coast, but the way people will get their piece of the pie won't be because government comes to the table. It'll be because a trial lawyer says, BP did you wrong. We will help you make you whole again. This is a real interesting opportunity to remind people what lawyers do versus what corporations do. And you need both in the end to be successful, but a successful lawyer keeps the corporation in check from abusing you.
At the end of this race, though, we've seen Tom Feagan, who I was a little bit surprised is in third place just because I think he's had more money than Bob Krause. And I think going in, Bob Krause might have had even less name recognition than Tom Feagan, not that he had a lot.
Right, yeah.
But that being said, you've seen him really go after Conlon on a couple things. You know, it isn't like she's a complete underdog here financially. She has a lot of her own money.
Yep.
So the same, I mean, there are going to be some things they paint her with. Her husband has obtained numerous federal tax credits to do housing development in Des Moines. And right or wrong, that's going to be attacked. And Feagan's already pointed that out. Also, you know, now he's going after sort of nitpicky things, the fact that they got their car washed and put it on the campaign dime. But she has reimbursed her campaign for the downtown office they use. I mean, she can't exactly be painted as this low-budget underdog.
No. No. Except, I mean, what she's, I think, trying to do is frame herself not relative to her Democratic opponents, but relative to Grassley.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
Relative to Grassley, exactly. She is the underdog.
Sure.
And she's very much the underdog. And so, you know, that I think that's where she takes that energy from. And you know, that's what fuels her campaign. I want to go back to kind of the general message of trial lawyers for just a minute, because I think Arnie's right in that there's a new way to describe trial lawyers.
Exactly.
Having said that, this is something that Roxanne Conlon has tried to do in previous races unsuccessfully. This is something that John Edwards tried to do unsuccessfully. I mean, that's not a new message.
But again, Rachel, I think this is an interesting time to approach the conversation again. Just because it didn't work when Edwards was doing it, or even when Conlon was doing it, doesn't mean that it isn't the time to remind people what the system is about. You know, and who ends up, who's your Joan of Arc? You know, was the CEO of BP your Joan of Arc? Was the CEO of Goldman Sachs your Joan of Arc? Was the CEO of, you know, ConAg your Joan of Arc? Or was it the person who took them on and said, you are doing damage to our environment, you are doing damage to our towns, you are doing damage to our mortgages? That's a very interesting
question. The problem is, I think that the voters are going to question the genuineness of that. Yes, they're taking those corporate interests on, but I think there's this perception that they're doing it for the financial gain and not for the little guy. And that's going to be a hard battle to overcome.
Yes.
in a couple of months.
I make money, so do you.
I want to throw out the phone number. If you have a question or comment, please join our conversation by calling 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. We'll get to some of those calls when we come back. You're listening to Talk of Iowa. It's Politics Day. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Janine Beck. It's Politics Day. We're speaking with New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson and Drake University Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations Rachel Caulfield. Taking your calls this morning at 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to the phone and talk to Linda in Cedar Rapids. Linda, thanks for calling Talk of Iowa. Let me click on Linda. Sorry, it's been a while, Linda. I apologize. I'm still learning the ropes sometimes. Are you with us?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I am. Okay, I was just wondering how long we're going to keep voting in the elderly men. Aren't both our senators in their 70s or about 70?
Yeah, they're both in their 70s.
Good
question.
Why are we so afraid to get new leadership?
All right. Well, Linda, let's pose that question to both Arnie and Rachel. One of the things that comes...
Yeah. Well,
because
if she moves to New Mexico, she'll have two women to choose from.
Does it come with, one, I mean, sometimes Iowans might be resistant to change, but it has also come down to the fact that when you've been in office a long time, comes with seniority, and it's a pretty compelling argument for them to make to voters that, well, you vote me out, you lose chairmanship or, you know, key positions on, you know, the Ag Committee, Finance Committee, things like that. Arnie, go ahead.
Well, having run for both Congress and governor, and this is just from the state of New Hampshire, and I don't think it'll be very different from Iowa. I think people don't really understand what happens in Congress. I think, you know, up until maybe just even this year, incumbency was a guarantee of re-election. You know, it was just, you know, you just had to, they had huge war chests, they had name recognition, they could bring back their earmarks and their money, and they could point to this college campus and this big dome and say, I brought you this dome, you know, all those kinds of things. And so it's almost easier to go with the past than to go with something unknown. So that's part of the reason why they end up, and they do market their seniority, because with their seniority comes more money from Iowa. I mean, let's be honest. But I think we're living in very, very interesting times, and for Republicans, very scary times, because exactly the argument that historically would sell in a general election from the Tea Party perspective is the argument which is why they want you to go. You know?
If it's so scary for Republicans, why are they so energized? I guess I'm not reading that the same way you are.
Well, I think it's there are Republicans and there are Republicans. The Republicans I'm referring to are the Tea Party protesters who found a home in the Republican Party. They did not find a home as independents. They did not find a home as Democrats. They found a home here. Now the question is whether their excitement, passion, and frustration will be enough to eclipse the Republicans who have historically voted for people like a Grassley or whatever. Not that Grassley has any competition, but if you look around the country, that really is the choice between those that are comfortable with the power and the prestige of the past and those that want change.
Yeah, and I would add, Rachel, from a political science perspective, and this is something that's been studied for a very long time, incumbents have huge advantages, and
huge.
The margin by which incumbents are winning has gotten larger over time. Yeah. And so not only are incumbents winning at an overwhelming rate, I mean, 95% of representatives, U.S. representatives who run for re-election are in fact re-elected. That says something. And I think part of it is, I think Arnie's right in the fact that people have no idea what goes on in Congress. But I also think as a result of a lack of understanding about what goes on in Congress, there's a real difficulty in understanding why you hate Congress but really like your individual congresspeople. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find Iowans who would say that either Grassley or Harkin have done a bad job. Partially because they don't know what Harkin and Grassley have actually done. Partially because the stories that they do see are stories that highlight the achievements of Harkin or Grassley. They highlight their trips home. They get nice little flyers that are sent from Washington with official congressional seals. They may not read anything in it, but tremendous name recognition comes out of that, a sense of kind of identification with this particular member of Congress. And you know, so it's not just Iowa, first and foremost, that likes its longtime members of Congress and its longtime senators. That happens everywhere. I have questions about how anti-incumbent this year is going to be. We've seen some real upsets so far. But, you know, the last time I checked the generic congressional ballot, which is just they ask a bunch of people, would you vote for a Republican or would you vote for a Democrat? Republicans win, but they win with only 42.4% of the vote over Democrats' 41.6% of the vote. This is not a runaway for Republicans. There seems to be some impression that that's what's going to happen, but I'm not yet convinced of that.
Just one more point. And that is, if a lot of people were invited into the Republican primaries who were part of the Tea Party protest, the problem is their candidates are losing in Republican primaries. What are they going to do in a general election?
Except for Rand Paul.
Yeah, except for Rand Paul has really almost tainted the entire national conversation about what does a Tea Party protester produce in the way of a viable candidate? So Rand Paul has really cast a shadow across the entire nation. And then you've got people, you know, like Sarah Palin, who's able to sort of appeal to both sides. But then, you know, I mean, the only thing we know about Sarah Palin is that she does these random endorsements with no theme. So this whole election is very, very curious. And I think we're not going to have a clue until probably a week and a half before the election in November. That's when we'll have a better idea. Right now, it's a crapshoot.
Let's take another call. Let's talk to Sharon in Johnston. Sharon, thanks for calling Talk of Iowa.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment concerning the Republican candidates.
For governor?
For governor, yes. They all want to eliminate or decrease property taxes and income taxes for corporations or businesses in Iowa in order to stimulate the economy. In the meantime, they're still using all the services and government giveaways at the same time, and that leaves the little guy, the workers, to foot the bill. And I just don't understand how people can buy into that and vote for any candidate. Plus, their social issues are just repressive. So I was just wondering what the commentators have to think about that.
All right, Sharon, let me begin with Rachel, just because, you know, you're here in Iowa. You've probably seen some of those talking points that all three have discussed, reducing taxes for corporations in an attempt to, you know, spur development in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is happening, again, in states across the country. So you're seeing a response to, a slow economic recovery at best. And the prominent response is we need to make it easier for businesses to flourish, and particularly small businesses to flourish. And one of the ways that you do that is you cut taxes on businesses, not just big corporations, but – and this is what you hear most often is that not that they're cutting taxes for big corporations, but they're cutting taxes for small family businesses and small family farmers in particular, which sells very well across Iowa, particularly in rural Iowa. So that shouldn't be a surprise that that's a prominent feature. I think one of the things, you know, moving forward, we see Chuck Culver kind of on the defensive about economic growth in the state of Iowa. But, you know, there have been a couple things that have happened this year that I think will be a centerpiece of the campaign from Culver's perspective. And even Branstad, you've seen come out and say, you know, we fixed this once before. We're going to fix it again, because Culver either doesn't know how
Or
is unwilling to do anything.
That's what the ad says.
That's right. I was going to say, that's his ad. And, you know, I think it's interesting purely because, you know, it's a pretty big deal when Des Moines, Iowa is named the number one city for business by Forbes magazine. That's not a small achievement. And I think Culver should use that more. But to say that our large corporations, our large businesses in Iowa aren't doing well, I think is well, it's going to be a big debate.
We only have a few seconds left before we get to the break. We've seen Culver go after Branstad. Mm-hmm. At least political reporters like myself are seeing a lot in our email inboxes of him pointing out parts of Terry Branstad's record
yep.
that he thinks are negative, and we're seeing, you know, a 527 group run advertisements in opposition of Terry Branstad. Is that because that's who Culver doesn't want to face? I mean, we're not even through the primary, and he's going after Branstad.
Well, yeah, negative advertising does several things. First of all, it sets up the general election campaign, and Culver clearly wants to start setting up the general election campaign with the expectation that Branstad would be the nominee. But furthermore, it actually decreases turnout. So I think the hope is that maybe some of Branstad's voters in the primary maybe get less enthusiastic about Branstad.
All right. When we come back, I mentioned in the lead that a couple of interesting races in Alabama. I just want to touch on them, though. I think you've made points about those races without even knowing the outcomes. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about corporations and their involvement in politics. You're listening to Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio.
When it comes to sunscreens, a really high SPF doesn't always mean you're protected. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. If you're going to be outside, sunscreen should not be the first line of defense. The Centers for Disease Control, the American Academy of Dermatology, and others recommend protective clothing, big hats, wraparound sunglasses, and staying in the shade.
Well, we at the Environmental Working Group believe that sunscreen should be the last line of defense against the sun rays, but we know that it's necessary for many people to use it on sun-exposed skin.
Sonia Lunder says a new study from her group found a lot of problems with sunscreens. Many contain suspect chemicals known as hormone disruptors, and the Environmental Working Group says it's skeptical about the sunscreens that claim SPF protection of 50 or as high as 100.
And we know the FDA is concerned that tests can't reliably measure and account for SPFs in that high range. And we also know that those products don't offer a similar amount of protection from the sun-damaging UVA rays,
giving users false security about protection from sun damage. Of the hundreds of sunscreens on the market, the Environmental Working Group says it can only recommend 39 of them. It blames the FDA for not finalizing regulation, leaving a lot of confusion about sunscreen claims. This is the Environment Report. Big, sweeping bridges can be architectural treasures, a real point of pride for a town. But bridges across the nation are crumbling. Sean Ali found East Chicago, Indiana, needs to remove its big bridge, the Klein Avenue Bridge. It's a punch in the gut for this proud industrial town, but some think it might be for the best.
It's an enormous bridge that let drivers soar over canals, trains, and industrial truck routes. But the local government and the state of Indiana didn't have the money for a fix, so they closed the Klein Avenue Bridge for good. This bothers Monica Serrano. She wonders, if the town is losing a bridge, what does that say about the town?
Why would I stay in this area? You know, if I know that the roads are deteriorating, people are just going to leave, why would I stay? I mean, I want to go somewhere where it's going to flourish.
Well, there are people who think removing the bridge is an opportunity to remake East Chicago for the better. One person who makes that argument is Christy De Laurentiis. She's with the Metropolitan Planning Council, a regional land use think tank. She says back in the day, big industry scooped up enormous stretches of real estate, including the shoreline along Lake Michigan.
You know, you can kind of see the lakefront from here.
I mean, it goes on for what seems like miles, mm-hmm. and there's nothing other than, beachfront that's cut off by fences mm-hmm. or, you know, very large industrial buildings, smokestacks and the like.
You know, they really have not taken advantage of the shoreline that they have.
De Laurentiis says the mills use fewer workers these days, and they need less land, too. So East Chicago is hoping to reclaim industrial space for an economic boost. Maybe developers would build new neighborhoods closer to the lake and pay a premium for it. Or, at the very least, residents could get more parks.
It seems, you know, a real shame not to have people picnicking and using the open space and really have their personal enjoyment within their own community.
De Laurentiis says the Klein Avenue Bridge makes things worse. It kind of blocks off the lake from the rest of the town. And no one would really want to risk any real estate or park development with the bridge in the way. So it's actually a good thing it's coming down. De Laurentiis admits this could hurt people's pride, but maybe that's the price of a better future.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
10:34, and Talk of Iowa continues in a minute here on Iowa.
This is Talk of Iowa, and I'm Janine Beck. It's Politics Day. We're speaking with Drake University Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations, Rachel Caulfield, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Well, there were a couple of big headlines out of yesterday's primary results in Alabama. The first being that Representative Arthur Davis lost his bid to become the Democratic nominee for governor. He is an African-American who actively sought support of whites for higher office, but there were apparently a combination of factors. He decided against the health care bill, voted against that, and he has some icy relations with black leaders. That apparently helped cause a landslide for State Agriculture Commissioner Ron Sparks, a white who then was backed by some of these African-American organizations that snubbed Davis. Arnie, let me begin with you. What do we learn anything out of that race?
Well, you can't run against your own party and win. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, he ignored the old guard. he ignored the Alabama Democratic Conference, which is the sort of the liberal Democratic caucus within Alabama. Basically, he ran assuming he was going to be the nominee for the November election and was already courting independents and Republicans. Woohoo! You got a primary first, honey. You know, it's like, and he got his clock cleaned. I mean, there were people all over the state. I mean, first of all, you probably had a group of whites that still might have an issue voting for someone who's black. So let's start with that as a premise. That's still true. That may not be a large percentage. It may be a shrinking percentage, but there is a percentage. And then you had virtually every single activist black political group in Alabama supporting the agriculture commissioner who is white. I mean, you don't have a prayer. You don't have a prayer because they're not going to support you. And as a result, he was running the wrong race, and he was also in the wrong party. It's just not going to work.
The other headline that I thought was interesting was that freshman Representative Parker Griffith, who was a Democrat turned Republican, was defeated in his bid for second term. Now, he's the second member of the House to be denied renomination this year. But as I said, he's another one of those members who turned parties. Rachel, is it just impossible in this day and age to switch parties and be expected to win a primary after doing that? You know, we saw Arlen Specter go down. Are voters saying, No. I don't trust you if you switch parties?
Well, this is Parker Griffith had several significant problems as a Democrat who had switched to become a Republican in the House of Representatives. And he, you know, chief among them, and this was played up in the campaign, was the fact that he had voted for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker of the House. Well, when you're a Democrat in the House of Representatives and the Democratic Party has agreed upon a Speaker of the House, you vote for the Speaker of the House and you vote for that individual. And that's the way Congress is run. And again, this gets back to kind of how much people actually understand what goes on in Congress. But the parties have a pretty tight hold on Congress. The problem he really had, even more so than Specter, was that you switch parties and then you immediately have to go into not a general election where you want support from
exactly.
from the party, but you have to go into a primary election mm-hmm. where the pool of voters is really very different and they are very committed to their party organization. And so that's a really tough sell on your part. For in Griffith's case, you know, as a member of the House of Representatives, you got 2 years total in office. And when, you know, a significant portion of that is you supporting Democratic priorities and then you walk into a Republican primary in Alabama, there are going to be some problems.
Sure.
And
let me ask you about that. Go ahead, Arnie.
Just one more thing, Janine, that let's remember that the partisans that vote in primaries are sophisticated partisans. So when you morph a candidate into Nancy Pelosi, in a general election, you go, who's that woman? But in a primary election, you know exactly what's going on. And I think that that's where it becomes a real problem because primaries matter, everyone. Primaries matter. You know, as we were talking about the gubernatorial race, Arthur Davis didn't recognize how important it was that he had to court the base. They weren't going to give it to him, you know, in Alabama. And that's absolutely true with someone who's going to switch parties. It really, really does make a difference, and it's a very, very hard sell. It's a very hard sell.
I'm going to ask our listeners, what do you think of someone who switches parties? Is that acceptable? Is that unacceptable? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Again, that phone number, 1-866-780-9100. Rachel, as I look at Iowa politics, we have had members of the Iowa House switch parties, and most recently, Dawn Pettengill mm-hmm. From Mount Vernon, right? Or Mount Auburn. Where is she from? Now it's going to escape me. Anyway, from eastern Iowa, she switched from Democrat to Republican, and largely in part because of some labor-related bills that she couldn't support. And on the face of it, you think, well, how can you not know when you initially run for office what party you belong in? But as I got to thinking about it, sometimes I think these citizens who have, you know, been working for a living, whatnot, they decide to run. Someone recruits them to run for office. They get down to the Capitol, and maybe they aren't aware of how partisan it is that they're going to walk into a caucus meeting and be expected to be lockstep with their party, and they find it a little daunting, or they find, hey, wow, I don't agree with my party on every issue. Maybe the other party suddenly looks more attractive. There's just no room for an independent voice hardly in politics. Is that a problem?
Well, it depends on your perspective. Certainly, if you're a member or spokesperson of the two major parties, not a problem at all. I think a number
But it's hard for me to imagine that one person can agree with their party 100% of the time. And they may do it on record, on paper, but even in their minds, aren't there going to be times where you just don't agree with your party?
Well, there are. Our legislative organizations, and not unique to the United States, but legislative organizations have to have some basic principle by which they are organized, some group of people who come together and figure out how things are going to work. Happens to be political parties. It's one of their core functions is to organize how elected officials behave once they've been elected, and they have to actually get something done. Parties bring people together in that sense. And so there's very little room for independence once you're actually elected to a legislative body. And I would suspect that particularly at the state level, a number of people who are elected are not ready for that. I think if you're elected to the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate, you have to be ready for that.
So it's less acceptable because these people that I'm talking about in Iowa politics have been reelected despite switching parties, which I've always been surprised by. So there's more forgiveness on the local level than there is once you're running for a –
There's more relationship on the local level.
I was going to say.
Go ahead, Arnie.
It's about relationships. These are not just candidates. They're people they know. They're from their communities. It's a smaller district. There's a greater set of intimacy. There's constituent service. There's all these things. Personalities matter. I was the first Democrat to ever get elected in my community, and part of the reason was everybody liked how I kept my house, you know? It's like, you know, she's a nice person. Look at how she cares for her kids. I mean, relationships matter at that local level. But I also want to make a point here. Parties change. Rachel, the Republican Party has changed. I mean, especially in the Northeast, I know a lot of disaffected Republicans who had to leave. They had to leave. Their party got too fundamentalist Christian. Their party became too anti-everything. I mean, they weren't opposed to government. They just wanted more effective government. And suddenly they were told, you know, you can't raise taxes. You can't spend money. You can't. It was a party they didn't recognize. They had come from this blue blood moderate Republican Party. And suddenly they looked at their party and they said, who's changed, me or you? So I think that that's part of what you can do. I'm not sure that the Democratic Party has changed except to become more like the Republican Party in the sense that it's become more corporate in some ways. And Barack Obama is an example of the problem with that corporate relationship. But parties do change, too, not just people.
That's absolutely true. And if you look at the kind of historical arc of the two political parties, they change dramatically over time.
Yeah. We got an email at Talk of Iowa. It's talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org if you want to contact us that way. We got one from Adam in Roland, who says he thinks the only real solution to our federal government is term limits for elected officials. He says, too bad no incumbent would ever vote for it. Arnie, you've had a change in position on that, right?
I've absolutely had a change in position. Absolutely. I was the most articulate advocate against term limits. I said, you're the term limit. You get to vote. You get to make a decision. It is about you, because I was so worried about the fact that the only people that wouldn't be term limited would be staff. Would be the bureaucrats, and then the people that I could control would eventually be told to leave, and I wanted that institutional memory. And then I suddenly began to realize you get something else. You get institutional rot, okay? You get an assumption that the seat is yours. You get the idea that somehow you lose connection with people, and I think that there's a greater loss from the institutional rot than the institutional memory, because I can always give you a book to read. You know, but I can't separate you from being there too long. But I will tell you one thing, Janine, and that this is the truth. I will never embrace term limits without some sort of campaign finance reform, because you will not get a real change without dealing with the money as well. They've got to be wedded at the hip.
And Rachel, you know, what about Adam's concern that no incumbent will ever vote for a term limit? Is there ever going to be enough public pressure to say to that, you know, because you have seen people run on that before. I mean, Leonard Boswell is one of those who talked about term limits and talked about serving a certain amount of time. And he is beyond that initial amount of years he said he would run.
Much like campaign finance, where legislators have no real incentive to change the system, legislators have no incentive whatsoever to institute term limits.
All right.
I think that's absolutely true.
I want to squeeze in a call from Susan in Ankeny. If you want to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Again, 1-866-780-9100. Susan, thanks for joining the program today.
Hello?
Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on Talk of Iowa.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I just thought it was interesting. Yesterday, Kel Thomas had written his op-ed piece that women should not have abortions because we need more taxpayers. And he kind of, the Republican spin on morality was kind of missing. So if you refer back to that yesterday's Register, I thought that was probably the baseline for the Republican Party now. That's where we're at.
So you thought it was interesting to frame it in economics versus a moral issue.
Absolutely. Right. And I think that's probably where, that's why I'm no longer Republican. So.
All right. Susan, thanks for the call. Arnie, did you happen to see that op-ed?
I didn't, but I'm thinking, well, that would be a reason to bring in more undocumented workers and make them legal. Because that should be your path to citizenship. There'll be more taxpayers. I mean, we can use that argument almost under any blush. And I didn't see it, but that is problematic when you look at children as merely an economic tool. And
well,
that's obviously what Cal was doing.
Yeah, there were a few Republicans in the early 2000s who also argued, for example, that one of the reasons the Democratic Party was in decline is because they were killing off the next generation through abortion. A claim that was actually brought up in, I believe, Freakonomics. And that's well, – go ahead.
What I want to make sure is that before we leave the topic and what Cal wrote is – sort of makes me want to take a shower, but more important than that is that we've been talking about the Iowa, you know, primary, and then we looked at the Alabama primary, and I just want to recommend that everybody take a look at the War Room from Salon.com, because every state is so different, and we would like to make generalizations about, you know, what did it mean that Arthur Davis lost, what does it mean that, you know, so-and-so won, and I just want to read you one sentence, because I think everybody should go to Alabama and almost, you should have eaten popcorn and watched the primary in Alabama, because they said the candidates running for various offices include a man who hates foreign languages and sex offenders, a black Democrat who hates Obamacare, a white Democrat who became a Republican, a black Republican who hates Obama, and the guy who installed the giant granite copy of the Ten Commandments in the state courthouse for attention a couple of years ago. So I just want people to understand that's the backdrop of the conversation we were having about Alabama. What's the backdrop for the conversation we're having in Iowa? And I just want everyone to understand that geography matters. And not only geography matters, but the sort of the swirling insanity of what's going on at the politics of the moment matter as to what the result looks like. And that's just a snapshot of what it must have been like in Alabama. Oh, my gosh. You know, the ads were better than the TV.
When I look at that as somebody who covers politics, Arnie, I always think as I compare us to other states, we never look as quite as interesting or salacious. And for voters, that's actually a good thing.
Yes.
For political reporters, sometimes we go, oh, man, when can we get a Rod Blagojevich? But
Iowa
for voters.
Boring. Iowa boring is maybe not such a bad thing.
Exactly. Right. We're talking politics this morning on Talk of Iowa with New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson and Drake University Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations Rachel Caulfield. We're taking your calls at 1-866-780-9100. We're also taking your emails at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. NPR did an interview on All Things Considered yesterday, and I heard some of it with William Galston that advocates for compulsory voting, fining people who don't vote to encourage more participation. He feels that'll cut down on polarization. He says we're at the worst point of Republicans versus Democrats polarization since the 1890s, and says with a voluntary system, only the most aggravated vote, and that people in the middle don't show up, and it's time that we need more moderate voters in the electorate. Rachel, can we find people that don't vote? Would that be tolerant? Would people tolerate that?
Well, if we made it a law, they wouldn't have a choice.
That's true.
I think there's this is one of those kind of ongoing debates that we have in the United States. And a lot of Western democracies do have compulsory voting, and they do fine people for not showing up at the polls. So it's not like this is
when I owned
kind of,
a townhouse, we had to do that for the annual meeting.
Yes. Yes. It's not, you know, it's not out of the ordinary. It's not some weird proposal, which some people seem to believe that it is. you know, the kind of prominent argument here is that voting is a right. It is not a privilege rather than a requirement of citizenship. And so in some ways, people say this is undemocratic to force people to participate in the process of voting. Having said that, if you look at those countries that that have instituted compulsory voting, not only do you have high rates of participation, particularly among moderate voters, but as a result, you're bringing in a lot of people who typically didn't pay attention to politics. This is another argument against compulsory voting. Do we really want all those people who don't care enough to pay attention to go out to the polls and vote? But one of the interesting things that we find is particularly among young voters, when you're forced to vote, you find more information. You make an effort to learn more about politics. And so in those countries that have compulsory voting, I think there are a number of very interesting trends that might recommend it.
Can you name any of the countries? I think I read Australia.
Australia.
So these are not countries that we've never heard of.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
And
Arnie, go ahead.
About it, though, see, I believe in compulsory service. I believe that we should have universal service and all of us should serve our country because there is responsibilities and there are rights and there are obligations. And I think voting is one of them. So I would sort of tailor this under my compulsory service. You know, I want you to join the Peace Corps. I want you to join the military. I want you to join AmeriCorps. I want you to vote. There are certain obligations of citizenship, and it isn't just to sit there. Okay? It isn't just to sit there. And I think as a result of that kind of compulsory service, as well as compulsory voting, you might get a more engaged population because you know what? You matter. Because you make a difference. Because you fix your country, because you fix your politics, because you fix your government, because you have to. Not because you want to, but because you have to. So there is now an obligation and a responsibility. And I think that changes. I think people care about public education because we all have to go. You know? We all really have to participate. And as much as it scares me, because a democracy, I like the volunteer nature of it, but I think we're also missing another piece, which is the community nature of it and the sort of sense of obligation to each other.
Okay, I want to move on to a new topic because we're running out of time and there's a couple I want us to touch on. Washington Post article talking about political ads being a tough sell for image-conscious corporations. We talked about that Supreme Court ruling that freed executives to spend unlimited corporate cash on campaigns. Arnie, you were very concerned about that. Has it had the impact you expected or have we not seen the rush to advertise from corporations?
They haven't found the way to be clandestine. See, that's what this is all about. It isn't they don't want to spend the big checks with commas in them, because they do. It isn't they don't want to influence the politics of November, because they do. What they don't want are their fingerprints to be found. So they are looking to be as clever as possible, which is one of the reasons why you noticed that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce said, not a problem, send the money to us. You know, money is fungible. They'll never follow your dollars. It'll go into the swamp of cash, and we'll basically do all the damage for you. But the interesting part of the article wasn't as much about reluctance to spend the money as to be identified with what they were doing. Isn't that depressing? I mean, I have to identify myself when I vote. People need to know who I am, but they don't want to be identified. They want to be clandestine. That's the part of the article that got me so depressed.
All right. Let me bring up something to you, Rachel, that caught your eye in the news recently, that a new Supreme Court ruling on Miranda rights. This seems to tilt it a little bit more toward police versus the suspect or the detained, arrested, whatever. Talk to me about what that ruling did and why, you know, the average citizen who doesn't think they're ever going to get arrested should care.
We all think that we're never going to get arrested, so we should never care until we are, as if I've been through it. But, knock on wood. This was a Supreme Court case that came down yesterday. It was the third case this year where the Supreme Court addressed the limits of Miranda rights and the extent to which police can question suspects before they have an attorney and before they knowing that they have a right to remain silent. So this one is Berkus v. Tompkins, and what the court said basically is if you wish to remain silent, you have to actually explicitly say that you wish to remain silent. It's not enough to simply remain silent.
So if they're questioning you for an hour, hour and a half, but you're just not speaking,
that's not
enough.
Right.
And you have to say, I
wish to remain silent.
Sure.
And this
so you have to actually.
3 hours.
he was being questioned for 3 hours, and at the 2 hour and 45 minutes of not saying anything, of really not responding, they finally asked him a question about, do you believe in God? And he said, yes. Do you think God will forgive you? And he said, yes. Do you think God will forgive you for killing this person? And he said, yes. Okay?
Now,
that's what happened. It's 2 hour and 45 minutes.
Sure. Let me ask you both, because I have to say, I'm trying to imagine the average listener thinking, okay, yeah, I want people to have rights, but on the other hand, if this guy killed someone and he finally admitted it 2 hours and 45 minutes in, too bad for him. You know, that's what some people are going to think.
Sure.
So why should we care? Most of us don't think, as you said, Rachel, that we're ever going to be arrested.
Yeah, it's, well, we should...
I don't plan on killing anyone. I mean, that's what they're thinking.
That's right. And let's remember that a number of suspects are brought in every year who did not commit a crime.
Sure.
And there are any number of ways that this could
and
affect
this
people.
This is about making sure the police aren't citizens. Abusive. This is about making sure the police aren't abusive. That's what this really is about. It's not about the guilty. It's about the police and their tactics.
Yeah. All right. Ladies, thank you both for your time today. Fabulous, interesting conversation as usual. We've had Rachel Caulfield, a professor at Drake University, and we've had analyst Arnie Arneson from New Hampshire. Thank you for your time. Remember, this is Talk of Iowa, produced by Dennis Reese, podcasting and on-demand audio available at iowapublicradio.org. We welcome your comments and questions at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Theme music composed and performed by Dan Knight. I'm Janine Beck. Thanks for listening.